Anonymous Alcoholic. Sobriety date is September 2nd of 2012. We got a wonderful sponsor who sarcastically gives me my inventory every week, and a wonderful home group. For some reason, I'm nervous. I've had the utmost respect for this group for so long. You guys were there when I started getting sober down here, and want to impress you, and my ego is all out of whack because of it. So just get that out of the way first. But I grew up, I was a military brat, moved around every 3 years like clockwork, went from, you know, Quantico, Virginia to California, Utah, spent some time in Japan, had a great life, you know, summer on my grandfather's farm, seeing the world. And despite all of that, I just had this fear growing up, and I couldn't enjoy any of it until, you know, now when I can look back and see I had such a great life. You know, I had this just underlying fear of people. I didn't know really how to interact or connect with anybody. And slowly, as I grew older, it became more and more prevalent. My dad eventually retired from the Marine Corps. He got a government job up in D.C., and I went from a school on base, which was about 500 students, including a middle school, high school combination. And then we went to a high school of about 2,000 students where I didn't know a single person out there. And that fear was just all over me. One of my classes, for some reason, I racked my brain trying to figure it out, but I could not remember why I did it. But I decided I'm going to bring in a 20-ounce bottle of Dr. Pepper filled halfway up with 18-year-old Glenfiddich. You know, the top shelf stuff. And then, you know, dilute it with Diet Coke. Yeah. I love that response from alcohol. You know. And I went to my second period computer drafting class, and I downed it within the first 10 minutes. And I was free. I have never felt that free. Well, I didn't feel that free up until then. But I felt like just another student. That football guy was 200 pounds, pure muscle. You know, I could easily take him in a fight, you know, despite being a very obese child. You know, that girl I had a crush on who I was too scared to talk to, she didn't matter anymore because I was better than, you know, and it was great. And the only consequence I got was the next period, my history teacher asked me to read something, and being drunk and unable to see words clearly, it didn't go well, and she told me to put my head down, then counted me as skipping for the day. That was it, you know. And I, you know, I've always had some attraction to alcohol, even when I was younger. My dad would give me, you know, he'd come home, pour his beer into like a frosty mug, he'd fill it just right with the foam, like, you know, like a quarter of an inch of foam, and I would watch him and just be mesmerized by it. And you, with now having the experience of feeling the effect by it, you know, a smart alcoholic would probably just chase that, but I was not a smart alcoholic. I did not chase it. My dad, being a Marine who had some anger issues, scared me to death, and I didn't want to get on his bad side. So I would drink on occasion when I could until I got out of high school, which I actually graduated down in Madison here, when he decided he didn't want this, you know, six-figure job and wanted to become a middle school teacher. You know, and I came here, graduated high school, started working at Prince Michelle. You know, great place for a new alcoholic, working at a winery filled with a bunch of alcoholics. Started my first taste of weed, which I was not smart. Apparently, you're supposed to smoke it, not eat it. So I didn't really feel any of the effects from it. But I would able to, the chef would give me a beer after the end of the day while I'm doing, finishing up the dishes or cleaning up the restaurant, and I decided that I'm going to be this big-time chef. And the only real reason I did it was because there was a friend of the family living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who said I could get into the school for free and live with them. the only reason I really wanted to do it was because he said I could drink at home, and he had an entire fridge full of Budweiser. And it was amazing. And I went out there for that reason, just to drink. It wasn't because I wanted to be a chef. It wasn't because the school was supposed to be, like, great for the culinary arts or anything like that. It was just I wanted to drink, and I wanted to be free from my parents. And I lasted, I think I attended school for about 4 months. I got a job at the Marriott where I would drink, and I had a blast. I had so much fun in that restaurant. We would drink at night. We'd drink the awful, warm, boxed wine. We played pots and pans bowling. We got snowed in one day, and we got the rooms there, and we all got trashed. It was fantastic. But all the responsibilities that I had, such as showing up for the guy, the friend of the family, keeping my place, my area clean, showing up for school, all that just started to not matter anymore. And my parents would call me out. I'm like, you're not showing up for school. This is what we sent you out there to do. And I was like, I'll do better. That alcoholic lie, I will do better. I got this. But it didn't happen. And I got to the point where my mother's mother died, and my dad, on a middle school teacher salary, flew me and my brother out to Georgia for her funeral. And I wanted nothing to do with it. I hung out with my brother, who was not involved as well. I argued with my mom about the way my dad was teaching or treating my brother, and it didn't matter. I just wanted to drink. And I wanted to hang out with my brother, who I thought was cool. And then I flew back, and I destroyed this relationship with the friend of the family. He kicked me out of the house. I moved into a Mexican ghetto, which, being a fat white boy, Mexican ghetto and me don't mix. I come home after work and have to drive through police line while they're searching for people. I go to sleep with the cockroaches. I would hear gunshots randomly throughout the night, but it didn't matter because I had that freedom of being able to drink and do whatever I wanted. But eventually I couldn't spend so much of the money that I barely made on drugs and on alcohol that I couldn't afford to be there anymore. And like a good old boy, I ran home to my mama, who welcomed me with open arms and simply said, just do better. And I got another job in a restaurant with my mentor chef at first. And I did great for the first 2 months until somebody offered me crack. And I said yes. And within a month, I got my first DUI, my first and only DUI. Eventually went off to rehab, learned of something about alcoholism. We went to 200 and some odd meetings within 30 days. So you would think I would have some perspective of it, but not really. I got out, said, I can do this on my own. Within 2 weeks, I was in the hospital. My liver was shutting down because I lost it all. My family kicked me out. I didn't have anywhere to go. So I took 200 ibuprofen, 50 Benadryl, and a bottle of Listerine trying to kill myself. And I spent a week or two in the hospital. And when I got out, the doctor told me that if I were to drink or drug within the next 6 months, I would be dead or back in the ICU. And a normal person would stop. It wouldn't be a question. But for me, as an alcoholic who has no control over whether or not I say no or yes or no, or how much I end up drinking when I start, it was just a matter of time. And it took about 2 weeks before I started a crack house down in the middle of Madison, where I was drinking harder than I ever had. And we'd have the cops visiting every Thursday at 7 o'clock. The only reason I remember that is because I had one of the ASAP classes that night, and they would interrupt it. And I spent 6 months just drinking, didn't shower, didn't brush my teeth, did everything that was put in front of my nose, and I was miserable. I was dying, and I really didn't know it, and I had no interest in really stopping. But eventually I get kicked out of this place because obviously the landlord doesn't want the cops there all the time. And I moved back home with Mama, like a good boy, and she gave me two options, to either live on the streets or to get into an Oxford house. And the only one available was, well, there were two, one in Virginia Beach, and it looked like a rundown shack, and the other one was in Northern Virginia. So I chose the one in Northern Virginia to get my family off my back. And in order to get the Oxford off my back, I had to get into meetings. And I found a wonderful group who have active alcoholics who love going out and doing stuff at night, who want to hang out with the new guy who's miserable and doesn't talk and looks like he might punch you for no reason. And I started following them around, but I still just had no interest in doing this. I had no interest in stopping. To me, my life was fine. I mean, who cares if I was in the ICU? Who cares if I destroyed families or my family relationship? It didn't matter. And I drank a few more times before I ended up homeless. And at one point, and I believe this to be a very, very strong God moment, I am homeless. I'm sitting outside of Starbucks where I worked, waiting for my shift to start. And my dad shows up, who lives an hour and a half, 2 hours away, just randomly showed up at my job. And while I'm before he shows up, I'm thinking, how do I get back home? How do I get back into my family so I can get out of here and do what I want to do? And he shows up, and I essentially beg him, can I come home? And he says, no, good luck with whatever you got going on, and left. And I was stuck with the decision to either be homeless or to fall back in with this active alcoholic group. And I ended up couch hopping. I'm a pretty, I don't like living on the street. It's not fun. So the idea of couch hopping was much better, and I fell in with that group. And I had to do what they were doing. I had to show up to meetings early and set up chairs, do coffee. I had to clean up afterwards. I had to go to the hangs. I had to do all sorts of stuff that I didn't want to do. But eventually, it became easier because I started getting this little bit of happiness and this little bit of ease and comfort. You know, and I got the sponsor, and I did the fourth step. I did the fifth step. Eventually got another sponsor, did the same thing, started making amends. I made a big amends to my sister. When I was younger, I tried to kill her because I was just so angry with life and she wasn't following what I wanted her to do that I put my hands around her neck and tried to kill her. And I made amends for it, and it was an insane moment, just baffling. Like, she forgave me. She told me how every time I got angry, she just relived it. And, it was a great moment in my life. Still is. But the fact was, even though I was sponsoring people, I did an honest fourth step, fifth step. I was doing my amends. I was calling my sponsor. I wasn't being honest in my life. I was taking horrible, horrible actions behind everybody's back when no one could see me. I was stealing from work. I stole from a charity. I cheated on my girlfriend at the time. I tried killing myself in a sober house by tying a noose in the back. I did horrible things because I wasn't fully ready to accept what we do here. And just like the book says, if our actions continue to harm others, we are sure to drink. If we're not sorry. I'm sorry, I'm misquoting. I'm horrible at that. I apologize. And that's the sad fact of my life, is that I didn't feel sorry for any of it. And I drank. And I spent the next 3 years in a little shack down in Charlottesville, and working in a restaurant. And there, if you looked at my life outwardly, there was nothing wrong with it. I had a job, I had a place, I had a car, I had a pretty sweet Jeep, actually. But inwardly, it was something else. It was no longer, I'm okay with this. It was, I need to drink this feeling away. I need to drink the memories of being in AA and being happy at these stupid events where I was cleaning up dishes from 200 people and laughing and making dumb jokes. You know, I'm sitting in my one-bedroom apartment and putting whatever I can up my nose, drinking, and feeling that alcoholic loneliness. I had nobody in my life. I had nobody I could call to. If I told my parents what I was doing, it was the end of that relationship. And eventually, as I am laying one night trying to fall asleep, all my brain was just focused on comparing my life then to what it was. And I scream cried to God, either kill me or show me what I needed to do. And then instantly the thought of calling an alcoholic who I got sober with popped in my head. It's 3 a.m. I'm not calling him. I know that he's not going to answer. And I said that if this is the first thought I had when I get up, I'll call him. And I instantly, after 3 hours of trying to fall asleep, I was out. I slept great. It was one of the best sleeps I've had. And I woke up, and of course, it was the first thought I had. And of course, being a fearful alcoholic, I shot him a text rather than actually call him because I was too afraid to face him. And we set up a plan, and I ended up showing up to it. And my idea was, I'm going to rekindle this friendship. I just need a friend in my life. That's all. His idea was, if he's not willing to get sober, I'm going to spend 5 minutes with him and I'm going to leave. And he recounts, I believe this to be false, but that I started crying in front of him. And, you know, that night I met up with my old sponsor. I asked him to be my sponsor again, and I started down this road. And it has been an interesting road. There have been a lot of ups and downs and a lot of fight left in me. You know, for the first 6 months, I thought about drinking every single day, every minute of every day. And I was pouring myself into this. And, you know, within my first couple months, weeks of being here, my sponsor got me on my 4-step. You know, I did it to my utmost, except that I left 3 things off that I didn't want to tell him. I didn't want to tell him that I was dating, quote unquote, somebody in Kansas that I've never met. I didn't want to tell him that I was still angry at this guy who stole my girlfriend, which he already knew. I forget what the last one was. But I do the 5th step, and not a week later did I drink. Because this program requires such honesty out of me, and I am unaware of what that actually meant at the time. And after I told my sponsor that I drank again, he simply says, you're dishonest. I was like, what do you mean? It's like, you hold secrets. I'm like, oh, that's dishonesty. I had no clue. And I told him what happened, and I gave him my full inventory on it. And for the next few months, like, I still questioned if I was an alcoholic. Like, it's really, I mean, looking back now, it's pretty stupid that I was in the hospital and told that I couldn't drink or I would die again, and I drank. It's pretty stupid that I was to question it when I, on my 27th birthday, it was the last day of my work week. I was working 20 hours that day in a restaurant. I made the decision that morning that I wasn't going to drink no matter what. And my coworker walks up to me and asks me if I wanted, he could buy me a beer on my birthday. And I said, no. He said, come on, I'll buy it. You don't have to pay for anything. And I said, okay. That simple. And then we went out for that one beer. And by the time we were done, like 4 or 5 hours later, I couldn't see the road correctly. And, you know, that's the bottom line of what an alcoholic is for me. So I can't control when I'm going to start, and I can't control the amount I'm going to take. There have been times throughout my life where I've been able to say no, been able to turn it away. There have been times where I've taken one drink after work, did my shift drink, went home, and was done. But those times are so few and far between. But my head allows me to take those and say, hey, look, I was able to control it, not an alcoholic. And somebody had to really sit down with me and go through the book to really get an idea of what an alcoholic was and what I was, and to help me see myself through that. You know, and I started off with this idea of God, of this punishing God, who the kid with the magnifying glass pointed at ants was the best description that I had. You know, when I was early on, my sister, she's got this disease where her body's essentially just falling apart. And they told her that she would be dead by the time she's 50. And this girl was going to conquer the world. Didn't say a curse word till she was 21. Full ride scholarship to college. Was just an amazing person and was given this disease, and I cursed God for it. Like, I didn't know what to do with it. And eventually I learned that it's not my place. That my place was to show up for her, be there when I can, despite when she is an unbearable person to be around. You know, she recently has said that she is a medium and talks to ghosts. But I have to show up for that. And whether I believe it or not, I have to show up. And that's my duty. And that's God's will for me. Mine is not to question what His is. What He wants of me outside of that. You know, and I also had to reflect upon what, on other occasions in my life, where God was not just like my dad showing up to Starbucks at a random time. There was another moment where I was leaving this house and I was meeting a girl at the bar. And as I'm shutting the door, one of my best friends was walking up drunk and suicidal. Like, no way is that a coincidence. There's no way that I'm going to drink and he is showing up just at the same time. You know, and then when I first came in, I was lucky enough to have worked with people when I left, and I was able to see them still around, see the change in them. This one little kid that I got sober when he was 18, just graduating college when I came back, had changed completely. Like, he was smiling, happy, he wasn't neurotic like he used to be. Another guy who I hated with the utmost passion. And at meetings, we had gotten it almost into fistfights because we just butted heads constantly. And I went out with him and another friend out into Shenandoah where he spoke. And afterwards, he made amends to me. And this guy is not one to make amends. This guy is not somebody I feel is an sober member of Alcoholics when I knew him past, and seeing that was God for me. You know, and I started trying to work on my defects, which have been horrible. I am one that is fear driven. Every action I take is based in some sort of fear. You know, when I cheat on my girlfriend, it was fear of being alone, so my delusional idea is that I'll find a different girl to be with, because that way I wouldn't be alone. The idea that drinking is going to solve some sort of problem, well, then this past year I had a surgery and my neck fused, and there's a chance that I'm going to have a $40,000 hospital bill that my insurance isn't going to cover. And I got into so much fear because I couldn't afford it. So much fear. My sponsor told me that I needed a bigger God, and that my fears were going to end up driving me to do something stupid, like put out a loan or sell something that I didn't need to sell, like my kidney. You know, and then so it was growth. It was a lot of sponsorship. All my defects have really grown because of my sponsor pointing them out. After a long time of me hitting my head against the wall with them, you know, and I started making amends again. One of my most memorable is this guy, this little, he was, I don't even know how to describe him. He was a child when I started sponsoring him. He was 18, didn't know anything about the world, just knew how to drink. That was it. And when I left, I didn't say anything to him. I just left. When I came back around, I found out that he was still sober, and he actually joined the army. And every time I see him, I would duck the other way to make sure that I didn't talk to him, because I was just in so much fear and so much shame for just leaving this kid who had 6 months sober without a sponsor. And the idea that I might have caused him to mistrust people was burdening me. And eventually my sponsor was like, yeah, you need to make amends. And we went out, and went out to set, got coffee, and I told him my part, my wrong, and what I could do to make it up for him, make it up to him. And he said, we're fine. That all I want you to do is bring a new guy to this men's retreat that we do every year. And that was it. And since then, we have become, we are so much better friends than we are sponsor. His dad had cancer. And just, I know what my job is there, is just to show up for him. And we spent 6 hours in the emergency room because he started bleeding. And I didn't want to be anywhere else. I didn't want to be in my bed because I knew what selfishness can do to me. And it just leads me simply back to another drink. You know, and I've started having to really dive into my meditation and prayer. There's somebody very, very close to me that is going through some really screwed up stuff. And I am full of rage most of the time. And there's an individual in the world that if I saw him, I'm not sure what I would do. And I have to sit there every morning and try to sit quietly, say a prayer, and try to see what I can do better throughout the day. And when I do things like that, that rage isn't there. I don't want to kill. I don't think about how I'm going to murder him and his family anymore. I'm just there. And when I don't, that anger quickly comes back. You know, I almost came over on Friday, I almost came across the table at a coworker because he was talking over me and I felt disrespected. And my boss actually called me out on it, and I had to quickly, again, look at my inventory and how I was holding on to things and not really telling. I actually don't think I was telling my sponsor about it. I didn't even think about it. And I wasn't telling my boss that this guy wasn't doing his job properly. And that was part of my job to do. And then working with new guys. I love working with new guys most of the time. There are definitely guys out there. One guy popped in my head, and he was the most annoying new guy I think I've ever encountered. Just kind of that little brother attitude where you try to poke fun at you all the time, and I'm not somebody who likes to be poked fun of, especially if I don't know you. But I showed up for him anyway. Called him out a couple of times, but I showed up for him, and watching him change, like he's become a man. He's become an adult where he's calm. He goes to school, he shows up, and he's in an AA. I can't tell you how many times I have seen him with a new guy in a car. It's been crazy. And those have been the bright spots in my life, is just seeing people change and seeing them show up to life. The guy who I met up with this time to get sober with, the last time I was around, his sister died, and he found her body. And I can't imagine what that was like. But I showed up for him, and I watched this guy stay sober through it. And his sister died a miserable, lonely, alcoholic death. And I saw him show up. I saw him get new carpet because of the fluid she left on the carpet. Saw him show up to his family and get these funeral arrangements done. And all I did was do whatever he asked me. And the guy was still around, and And when I came back, he was a lawyer. He was trying to become a lawyer, and he was in law school. And, you know, we kept talking, and he tells me how hard he's struggling with, studying for this bar. And I was there with him. I took his calls when he was angry about it, or, you know, taking his frustrations out on his girlfriend rather than realizing what was really going on. And one day he comes to a meeting and he tells me he's passed the bar. I actually just got goosebumps, but it was the most memorable point in my life, or at least as far as being happy for somebody else, because there was nothing I did for that. I just took a call. I was just a friend. And when he told me that, I gave that man the biggest hug I've ever given anybody. And he's a big boy, and that was difficult to do. And it's things like that just keep me coming around. It's not sitting in a chair listening to somebody talk that I don't relate to. It's the outside of this, when the new guy who I see struggle, who can't stay sober for the life of him, suddenly the light comes on. Suddenly he's starting to help others. And that neurotic mind of his, where he doesn't know if he's an alcoholic or can stay here or not, turns off. And he's happy. One of my sponsors was just like that. He struggled for years coming in and out. And I hated him. I hated him. It was just the opposite of person that I like to be around. And one night he gives me a call and says, "I need help. I need you to pick me up from the hospital because I just tried to kill myself last night." And because somebody did literally the exact same thing for me, I showed up. And I've watched that man change from that moment on. From this snarky little, I'm trying not to cuss, but it's really hard when trying to describe this individual. I've seen him graduate college this year and get this big time job at Capital One. I can go on forever describing situations like this. It makes me unbelievably happy, and it keeps me coming around. It's not the little individual successes that I get, getting a job, getting like a pat on the back for the report I wrote. It's none of that. In the end, I don't really care about it. I mean, it helps my ego, but it's the other people's successes that make me happy, that make me want to stay around and see that new guy who sweating in the back and not knowing if he's an alcoholic or not really get this. Don't know what time I'm supposed to finish, but I'm going to end up talking more than I really should. So thank you guys for letting me share.